Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Ora Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. A Greenland-sized amount of ice has disappeared around Antarctica. That's a lot. And its consequences will, quite literally, have ripple effects for the rest of the world in the form of rising sea levels. And on the life of Terry Anderson, the American journalist who was held hostage by Hezbollah militants for almost 7 years. He wished that his years of captivity wouldn't define him, but perhaps that was beyond his control. First up, though, in an ideal world, bad ideas would fade into irrelevance. In Britain's ruling Conservative Party, they have a good chance of becoming official policy.
This Parliament just refuses to get Brexit done.
The British people voted for change. They voted to leave the European Union.
Divorce the country's largest trading partner. Sure. Send asylum seekers to Africa. Let's do it.
Being relocated to Rwanda is not a punishment, but an innovative way of addressing a major problem to redress the imbalance.
This week, after much legal wrangling, the Tory party finally got its way. A bill that allows Britain to send asylum seekers to Rwanda is now law. Now, there is clear momentum behind another scheme, leaving the ECHR, the European Convention on Human Rights.
The European Convention on Human Rights sets out individual rights and freedoms on everything from freedom from torture to the right to free speech.
Meehan Ridge is a Britain correspondent for The Economist.
It was drawn up largely by British lawyers in the aftermath of the Second World War to ensure that the atrocities of the Holocaust were never revisited. And the thinking behind it broadly was that nations need checks against tyranny. For chunks of the Tory party, the convention and the court that oversees it have both long been irritants because it seems to undercut sovereignty. And now some Tories are gathering behind the idea that it's actually worse than that and Britain must leave it.
Meehan, why is the ECHR ruffling Conservative feathers now?
The ostensible reason is that in June 2022, it messed up Tories' big plan for dealing with the small boats problem. That is, asylum seekers crossing the English Channel to claim asylum in Britain. The court felt sure that they wouldn't be safe being sent to Rwanda, which was the British plan, and so it blocked the flight the day it was due to take off to Kigali. Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, has since warned that no foreign court will be allowed to stop the Rwanda scheme from getting off the ground.
The first flight will leave in 10 to 12 weeks. Now, of course, that is later than we wanted, but we have always been...
So the European Court of Human Rights issues injunctions pending a full hearing from another court. And then in November last year, 2023, the Supreme Court ruled that indeed asylum seekers weren't safe in Rwanda. It was an unsafe country, effectively. This week, Parliament passed a law that designated Rwanda safe so that it could send asylum seekers there.
The question is that motion A be agreed to. As many as are of that opinion will say content... Contrary, not content. The contents have it.
It absolutely isn't safe. And the law effectively allowed ministers to ignore similar injunctions and also the ruling of the Pius Court in Britain, the Supreme Court.
So the ECHR has blocked this Rwanda policy. Is that why the Conservatives dislike it so much?
The Rwanda policy is an excuse, really. It's a very convenient one because it blocks an immigration policy. And immigration is one of those issues that's long united those on the right. The court's not perfect, broad laws based on rights, which is obviously the way that it works out what should be legal or not, lend themselves often to very problematic interpretations. So in April, the court ruled that Switzerland's failure to combat climate change had violated the right to privacy of a group of women. Lots of people think that that's not the business of courts, it's a business of governments. But another ruling has really gone largely uncovered, and that's a ruling in 2002 which allowed a British trans woman, that is a biological male, to change her birth certificate from male to female. That led to the Gender Recognition Act, which allows people, let's say men, to change their legal sex without having had surgery. And thus things like placing male-bodied people in women's prisons, and to the general acceptance of the idea that people can change sex, trans women are women. And Britain's now trying to roll that back. But a lot of it started in the European Court of Human Rights. Another criticism is that the court is just far too opaque. Until recently, judges could issue emergency injunctions without being named. But all of this doesn't quite add up to a compelling argument for flouncing out of the convention or the court.
Why not?
There are several reasons. The first is that on asylum, the court was backed up by Britain's highest domestic court, the Supreme Court. The ECHR doesn't actually say that any country has to grant asylum, but it does guarantee the rights of any individual in a member country. The Supreme Court ruled last year that Rwanda was effectively unsafe. And that judgment was based on lots of international agreements and laws, not just the European Court of Human Rights idea of how people should be treated, which argues actually that a fairer target of Tory anger might be the Geneva Convention on Refugees, which has this very capacious definition of what asylum is. It makes it quite difficult for governments to turn down certain people. So the problem of illegal migration into Britain is made much worse by Home Office dysfunction. And I think the convention and the court has become a very useful scapegoat for a multifaceted problem that's largely actually of the government's making.
Moving beyond the question of asylum, why else might Britain want to keep the court?
So there are a few reasons. Withdrawal would needlessly suck up time and energy for really very little reward. It would send another bad signal about Britain to the wider world, particularly after Brexit. Britain's appeal has long rested on the fact that it follows the rule of law. It really doesn't want a reputation for rescinding from agreements that it doesn't much like. It's a really bad look to reject a court that's ruled against you using rules that you have helped draw up. And the court can be pragmatic. So from time to time, it makes reforms to the way it operates. So recent changes, which are largely thanks to British efforts, include things like the court has changed a protocol to emphasise that countries are often the best arbiters of their own business. And other changes on how the court can issue emergency injunctions were also made only earlier this year after pressure from Britain. But Tory hardliners seem completely disinterested on amending things from inside.
So there are reasons to stay in, good ones actually, but given the state of the Conservative Party and this looming election, they may not be in a position to even leave the ECHR anyway, right?
So Labour has a commanding lead in the polls and it has no plans to quit the ECHR. If it wins, therefore, Britain won't leave anytime soon. But the Conservatives could be back in power in 5 years. And if leaving the court and the convention become their settled position, it could become a bit like Brexit, where a sort of quixotic pursuit matters more to the Tory party than anything else in its manifesto. Leaving the ECHR will almost certainly become a litmus test for leadership candidates if Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, is turfed out at the next election, as he almost certainly will be. And then another bad idea will be advanced on the path to becoming policy. It does feel a lot now like the run-up to Brexit in that sense.
Okay, but for now at least, the ECHR seems here to stay. And even though it opposed the Rwanda policy, that still seems set to go ahead.
Yeah, legal challenges are still expected on behalf of individual migrants as soon as we know who they are and when their plane is due to take off. The Prime Minister has been very adamant about getting this off the ground. And of course, there's an election this year. He'll be wanting to appeal to the right of his party and to voters on the right. I think it's worth remembering, though, what this policy actually involves. It's cost hundreds of millions of pounds. Rwanda has actually said it can only take a few hundred asylum seekers a year. So it's really unlikely to act as a deterrent, at least for a while. It's also involved passing a law that requires civil servants to pretend something that isn't true, that Rwanda is a safe place to send asylum seekers to, and courts to ignore the Supreme Court, the highest court in the country. So even without leaving the European Court or the Convention, it has already reduced Britain a lot in the eyes of the world.
Mian, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Ore.
what's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
There was a time when Antarctica was known only as a vast continent of ice and snow. Immense nothingness. And it is vast. Antarctica is home to the world's largest ice mass by a factor of 10. As more researchers, film crews, and even tourists arrived, it came to be seen as an explorer's playground. For some, it's a utopian land of scientific cooperation, or a poster child for environmental protectionism. But it's now clear that the continent is experiencing some massive changes. In the 90s, researchers didn't believe that Antarctica would be significantly impacted by climate change.
Climate change models at the time suggested that in a warmer world with a warmer atmosphere, you would end up having more snowfall in Antarctica, causing its ice sheets to grow.
Catherine Bouaïc is The Economist's environment editor.
That understood knowledge of the time turns out to have been completely wrong. And a really striking illustration of this happened last year when there was a dramatic reduction in the quantity of sea ice floating around the southernmost continent, which at the time prompted some glaciologists to wonder where a Greenland's worth of ice had disappeared.
Sorry, a Greenland's worth of ice has disappeared around Antarctica?
Just to be clear, what we're talking about here is, in a sense, the outer rim of ice that floats around Antarctica. It's known as sea ice. It gets more expansive in the colder winter months. It shrinks down a little bit during the warmer summer months. And what was really quite striking was that during the winter months, researchers noticed that the expanse of it was significantly smaller than in previous years. It had effectively lost the equivalent of the area of Greenland. So that's a really striking indicator that something is going on in Antarctica. It's not actually the only extreme that researchers have noticed in the last decade or so.
What do you mean by that? What else are they looking into?
So there's been some extreme heat waves. In fact, the most extreme heat wave ever recorded on Earth anywhere was in Antarctica. Temperatures rose by, I think it was 38 degrees above the norm for that time of year. And then you have these changes, not just in the floating ice, you've also had floating ice shelves breaking up, some really catastrophic collapses. More concerning is really what's happening on land, in a sense, because the land ice, and this is what's known as the ice sheets, is currently locked away from the oceans. But if it were to go into the oceans, then it would start contributing to sea level rise. And the bad news there is that some of it is already starting to move into the oceans.
And how do researchers explain what's happened to all that ice?
So really what's going on is obviously climate change. But the mechanics of it are both very complicated, very different for the different types of ice, whether you're looking at ice on land, these ice sheets, or floating ice, whether it's the ice shelves or the sea ice.
So let's start with the floating bits.
Yeah. So as I said, there's two parts to the floating bits. There's the sea ice, so that outer rim of ice. Researchers focusing on that type of ice have noticed a major shift over multiple years in how the ice behaves. And in particular, it seems to be shifting into a more variable, potentially less stable state. Then between the outer rim and the continent, you've got these massive expanses of solid floating ice. These are known as the ice shelves. And when you see pictures of Antarctica with big icebergs carving off the side of big flat sheets, those are the ice shelves. Now, we've seen some catastrophic collapses of different ice shelves around the continent in the last 20 years. So you're having big changes in both of these types of floating ice.
Okay, well, that already doesn't sound great. You told us about the ice shelves. Tell us about the ice sheet across the terrestrial part of the continent.
Yeah, so just to pick up where we left off with the ice shelves, the stability of the ice shelves really matters because they're hugging the continental edge. They sort of hold in these massive ice sheets that hunker down on the landmass. And so if you start to get fragmentation at the continental margins in the ice shelves, then that kind of releases a cork to allow the ice sheets to flow more quickly towards the oceans. And that is something that we're starting to see. There's solid data now to show that ice from Antarctica and from Greenland are increasingly important contributors to sea level rise around the world. And if that change continues as we expect it to in the years and decades to come, then they will soon be the largest contributor to sea level rise around the world.
How much of a sea level rise should the world be preparing for?
That's a hugely difficult question to answer, and the estimates vary massively. But just to give you a sense, projections vary from anywhere between, say, 10 centimetres to half a metre by 2100, or even more than that in some of the more extreme scenarios. The reason for which these numbers vary so widely is because on the one hand, there are uncertainties in terms of human behaviour and human response to climate change and how emissions are going to progress in the coming decades. But more importantly, the model projections of what will happen to Antarctica in the future don't fully agree.
Katrine, is the world ready for this?
What happens in Antarctica does not stay in Antarctica. The Antarctic ice sheets hold enough water to, if they were to collapse in their entirety and slide into the oceans, raise global sea levels by 60 metres overall. We need to be very clear that that's not happening within anybody's lifetime today. And also, it may not happen fully, but it is a phenomenal amount of water. It's also really important to note that you don't need all of that water to end up in the oceans to have a huge impact on populations around the planet. Ice that flows into one part of the ocean doesn't just stay there. And in fact, because of quirks of gravity, it tends to travel quite far away. So ice melting off of the Antarctic continent is actually destined to become sea level rise in the Northern Hemisphere, in Europe and in North America, for instance. And then there are other impacts. The climate changes that are happening in Antarctica have consequences for rainfall elsewhere, for monsoon patterns elsewhere. Antarctic ice is a really important contributor to the flow of nutrients into the rest of the oceans. And those nutrients determine things like the health of fisheries. So the bottom line here is that it may be very, very far away from most of us, but the consequences will be felt by the bulk of the population.
Katrine, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Ori. Always a pleasure.
Beautiful day, and the sun was shining clear, and I'm just kind of bathing in this warm glow. And then especially now, we took a few minutes to get some hugs and kisses from my family, my brother and my sister and Father Martin and my cousin Tom and his wife Sue. And well, you're lucky I can talk right now. I'm just about choked up.
Terry Anderson always insisted that his 7 years of captivity in Beirut as a hostage of Hezbollah militants was only a part of his life.
Anne Rowe is The Economist's obituaries editor.
He had done a lot both before and after it. He'd been a Marine, he'd gone to study journalism at university, then he'd gone to work for the Associated Press in South Africa and Japan. Then he had volunteered for the Beirut office, even though there was a civil war raging in Lebanon. He was fascinated by wars, and particularly by that one. And he managed to have rather a good time in Beirut as well. He managed to make a very pleasant life of it, even though he was also reporting on the horrors of a war. And after his captivity too, he did a good deal. He became honorary chairman of the Committee to Protect Journalists Abroad. He also helped homeless veterans, and he started an organization that built schools in Vietnam. So he was doing a lot of good work. But he also went in for a number of ventures or adventures that didn't turn out so well. A couple of restaurants that went bust, a bar that didn't thrive. He tried running for the state senate in Ohio. He lost. Although he married three times, he also divorced three times. So although he did not want his captivity to define him, in a way it kept doing so. It had made him a hero, of course. He also wondered whether it had made him more stupid than he had been before. It was the 16th of March in 1985, and he was playing a game of tennis in the early morning by the sea. And he noticed as he was playing that there was a green Mercedes sedan that kept cruising around, round and round the court. The same sedan had cut him up the day before. He was a little bit worried about it, but finished the game, started driving home, and then the green Mercedes pulled up alongside him, and three men with 9mm pistols jumped out and bundled him into the Mercedes, took him off. And that was the last he saw of the world for 2,454 days. He didn't fear that his captors were going to kill him. He knew he'd been taken because, first of all, they thought he was a spy, acting as a journalist as he did. But also, he knew they wanted to trade him for colleagues of theirs who'd been taken prisoner. So he was not afraid of that, but he was afraid of how he'd be treated, and with good reason. They were not very educated young men. They suddenly had power over this enemy, an American. He found he was frequently beaten, and he was chained and often blindfolded and kept in small, damp cells. He was moved around a great deal as the war ebbed and flowed, sometimes in Beirut, sometimes in the Bekaa Valley or in South Lebanon. And when he was in transit, he was either strapped to the chassis of a truck or he was taped up and carried in a coffin like a corpse. He spent, he reckoned, about a year and a half of his nearly 7 years captivity in solitary confinement. And this he found almost unendurable. He said he almost went insane. He was a man of some faith. He was a Christian. And he tried praying for hours when he was in solitary, but he found he seemed to be addressing just a blankness or talking to himself and not really talking to God. He was very inclined to think that the world had just forgotten about him. In the end, three things helped him get through. The first was his training as a Marine, which had taught him self-control and self-discipline. He found that was extremely useful. Then there was a sort of natural stubbornness that he had, so that he thought every day as he woke up, I can't do this, but I will do this. I'll just go on. That insistence that however dreary or hopeless things looked, he would carry on and do what he had to do. But the third really important factor was company. The reason that solitary confinement had been so awful was that he needed people. He needed to talk. He had as colleagues people like Brian Keenan, John McCarthy, Tom Sutherland, and he became, in a way, the leader of the group of hostages. It was not until the 4th of December 1991 that he actually found himself in Wiesbaden in Germany, hugging his family and his colleagues at the AP office and showing every sort of joy and jubilation at being free.
Harry, couldn't have been better. I couldn't have dreamed it like this.
Harry, welcome, Harry.
Thank you.
He seemed on the surface when he came out to be almost unchanged, same big glasses, same fine moustache. He convinced other people and he had convinced himself that he hadn't been changed by this. And it was only gradually that he realised he had, in fact, been badly damaged by it, and so had they all been. He knew people who had had to go to a mental hospital afterwards, and some had not emerged from the mental hospital. Their captivity had taken a huge toll. If you asked him, had he been changed by his captivity, he would simply say, "I am what I am."
Anne Rowe on Terry Anderson, who has died aged 76. That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. The show's editors are Chris Impey and Jack Gill. Our deputy editor is Jonjo Devlin, and our sound designer is Will Rowe. Our senior producers are Rory Galloway and Sarah Larniuk. Our senior creative producer is William Warren. Our producers are Maggie Kadifa and Benji Guy. And our assistant producer is Henrietta McFarlane, with extra production help this week from Jonathan Day, Peter Granitz, Anne Hannah, and Izepa Macias. We'll all see you back here tomorrow for the weekend edition of The Intelligence.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move. By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America NA, copyright 2024.